Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
The Hebrew Bible is filled with narrative doubling that can be a challenge to interpret. Through an interdisciplinary model, Joshua Berman offers new insights into how battle reports may serve as oblique commentary and metaphors for the non-battle accounts that immediately precede them. Battle scenes are revealed to stand in metaphoric analogy with accounts of a trial, a rape, a drinking feast, and a court deliberation, among others. Join us as we speak with Joshua Berman about his book, Narrative Analogy in the Hebrew Bible. You're listening to New Books and Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Joshua Berman is a lecturer in the Department of Bible at Bar-Ilan University, Israel. His other books include The Temple, Its Symbolism and Meaning Then and Now, also Created Equal, How the Bible Broke with Ancient Political Thought, and Ani Ma'amin, a book on biblical criticism. Joshua, welcome to New Books and Biblical Studies.
Oh, thank you, Michael, and welcome to all of our listening audience.
So, Joshua, tell us about yourself and your family.
Oh, wow. So I am originally from the New York area. I am an Orthodox Jew. I'm a rabbi. I did not grow up a rabbi or an Orthodox Jew. My parents are Jewish. But I kind of came to religion around the time of my bar mitzvah, around the age of 13. And I made Aliyah. I moved to Israel right after I finished Princeton, where I did my BA at the age of 23. And I've been here now for close to 36 years. And did my graduate work at Bar-Ilan University, where I teach to this day. Recently became a grandfather.
Congratulations.
That's the short of it.
Your book is on narrative analogy in the Hebrew Bible. Would you explain for us what you mean by narrative analogy and what led you to pursue this study?
Sure. Okay. So this actually was the published version of my doctoral dissertation, written under my mentor, Professor Edward Greenstein. Within the study of biblical narrative, and for the purpose of our discussion here, when I'm speaking of biblical narrative, speaking of Hebrew, the Hebrew Bible, we find a remarkable phenomenon that is subtle and can only really be picked up if you're really attuned to the biblical Hebrew and the word plays that are going on. That is, that narratives will echo one another, not merely by explicitly invoking, when we saw this with Moses or we saw this with Abraham, not even explicitly, and not even implicitly by just, kind of paraphrasing a verse that it appeared earlier in scripture, but that the whole structure of a story follows very closely the structure and language of a previous story, to the point that it seems to be in conversation with it or making a commentary to it. Let me give an example of what I'm talking about here, because this is something that I think most people are familiar with the Bible, will read the Bible regularly, will often be focused on the passage at hand, the story at hand, and might not be attuned to the ways in which Scripture is broadcasting to other stories. There is a remarkable similarity between Moses at the burning bush, Mount Horeb, Exodus 3, and Israel at Sinai in Exodus 19 to 24. We can see how those two narratives follow the same plot structure, that you have the protagonist, let's say Moses in Exodus 3 and Israel in the Sinai. They both approach the mount. They are told to make some preparatory gestures to prepare for revelation, whether it's removing your shoes in the case of Moses, or whether it's purifying themselves in the case of the Israelites. You have revelation as a fiery, scary sort of thing, with the protagonist not quite clear what's going on. You have God speaking to the protagonist for the first time in both stories, identifying himself, giving them their task, their calling, if you will, and moving on from there in both narratives to the protagonist kind of rebelling. Moses, halfway through the story, he gets cold feet and doesn't want to go, doesn't want to be Moses, defies what God says, and God gets angry with him. And the Israelites, likewise, at Sinai, no sooner do they receive the tablets and the covenant, but they rebel with the golden calf. And sure enough, here too, God gets angry, and there's kind of a need to come back to equilibrium. So and there's lots and lots of linguistic parallels between those two stories as well. But this is what we mean by a narrative analogy. The entire narrative, two entire narratives are analogous, which then begs the question, what is Scripture trying to say by doing this? And then that can go in many directions. But that is the basic observation. And it comes up in many, many, many places. I've given you an example of two stories within a single book, but often these narratives, these analogies, will cross across books, that one book will echo a story much earlier in a previous book.
We could even add a third parallel to your illustration, when Joshua bowed down before the messenger of the Lord in the book of Joshua.
Okay, that's another good one, right, that invites comparison. You have Joshua in Joshua chapter 5, I believe it is, right before the conquest of Jericho, in chapter 6. And there too, it's an epiphany. It requires Joshua to cleanse himself or to remove his shoes. There is a calling, etc. Yeah, but it's also somewhat similar, right? Or the splitting the crossing of the Jordan River in Joshua chapter 3, where the waters are stocked up. The language there is very reminiscent, of course, of the splitting of the sea. There, actually, Scripture is explicit about it. God says to Joshua, see, now all of Israel will know that you are as great as Moses because the waters have stopped and you are crossing. But it's rare that Scripture in its exposition gets that explicit about what we're meant to learn from these analogies. The Hebrew Bible, to my reckoning, has about 70 battle stories. By a battle story, I mean not just that a battle had happened, but some description of its flow, of its development, of more than, let's say, four or five verses. What we would call a story, we can say, here's a beginning, here's a middle, here's an end. And that's an awful lot of battle stories. There's an awful lot of long battles. You know, it's about the nation, it's about the land, and so therefore there are going to be battles. And what I noticed or tried to bring attention to was that in a number of cases, about six cases, where we read these battles and the description is very detailed about the unfolding of the battle, that gives the initial impression of verisimilitude. This is the way it happened. First they were here, they ran to there, they killed off this number of people, they encircled. Just seems to be a description of what was. That when you look carefully at the story that precedes the battle, off the battlefield, in the previous chapter, that lo and behold, the battlefield development, the development of the battle, the way it's described winds up being an analogy for what happened off the battlefield in the previous chapter. That's what the book is about, that phenomenon. I tried to give six cases.
Now let's look at some examples from your book so we can see something of the function and point of these analogies. Would you tell us about the narrative analogy in Judges between the battle against Benjamin and the difficult story of the rape of the concubine?
We will recall at the end of the book of Judges, the concubine at Gibeah, where this couple, if you will, was sojourning and traveling, and they arrived at some place in Benjamin, town of Gibeah, and they were put up for a few nights, and the townsfolk were not particularly hospitable to them. And ultimately, he pushes out his concubine, and the townspeople ravage her and victimize her. And then she winds up getting cut up to pieces, and it's really just a horrible story. In itself, that story is already an analogy, analogous to the story of Sodom, with Lot and his journey there, and the request of the people that, you know, give over one of their daughters for them to victimize. But for my purposes in this book, what I tried to show, we recall that following that story of the victimization of the concubine, that the rest of Israel is absolutely scandalized that such a terrible thing could have happened. And the rest of the tribes take upon themselves to avenge this terrible crime by taking the tribe of Benjamin to task, by going to war against Benjamin. And there's a very long, three long battles that are described there at the end of Judges 20. And in the last episode there, it describes the kind of the final stand of the tribe of Benjamin as they are encircled and then decimated by the other tribes. And when you look carefully at the imagery and the language that describes the decimation of the tribe of Benjamin, lo and behold, it is very reminiscent of the ravaging and the victimization of the concubine by the men of Benjamin in the previous chapter. And so this is what I mean. You have a battle story that just for all appearances seems to be just a description. This is what happened on that day on that battlefield. But then you look and you see, wow, no, this has been carefully crafted. And it's been molded in such a way as to remind you deliberately of the previous story and the previous chapter off the battlefield. What does this all mean? Well, in that particular instance, I think it could be taken in one of two directions. It could be, you know, you all of Israel, you think that Benjamin was savage. Well, you're no different. Savagery seems to be a widespread phenomenon at this time in Israel. Or it could be what we call in Hebrew, midah keneged midah, measure for measure. That is a frequent form of theme in biblical punishment. That is that the punishment somehow seems to fit the crime just right. So if the Benjaminites had encircled and ravaged the concubine, then they themselves will be encircled and ravaged in punishment.
Would you offer us maybe one more example from your book?
Yeah. So let's see with Joshua, the story of Achan. Okay. So we will recall that story there is that at the end there's this trial and they wind up having to stone him and putting the kind of like a cairn of sorts where he was buried. And we find the same thing happens in the next story, which is a kind of corrective following the battle at Ai that we have at Ai. We have the defeat of the king there. And the treatment of the king there is very similar to the treatment of Achan himself, and perhaps shows that you know, now that they have repaired or have corrected that which went astray, so now you can see that things have now returned to a proper course.
So, what are some of the conclusions you draw from your studies?
This issue of narrative analogies is really all over the place, and. And it always invites really important questions as to what scripture is trying to do. So that, you know, just to go back to the example that I opened with, within the book of Exodus. So what is this about really that Moses at Horeb at at Horeb is the same as Israel at Sinai. And the truth is that that analogy goes even deeper, because we can see that the life of Moses, as it's depicted in chapter 2 of Exodus, it mirrors the trajectory of Israel once they come out of Egypt. That is, you have Moses, it says that he grew and he went out from his house. That's chapter 2, verse 11. And that's like Israel going out. You have that Moses gives a makah, bayach, the word makah, which is the word for plague. It's the same root, strike. He strikes the Egyptian, and God strikes the Egyptians. Moses doesn't have any water. The Israelites in chapter 16 don't have any water, and then Moses winds up in the home of his father-in-law Jethro, who then feeds him bread. And the Israelites also needed bread, and so you have those two things as well. So that the analogy between Moses and Israel is great, but what of it? What is it meant to tell us? Is it meant to tell us? And you know, Scripture doesn't give you the answers to these things. You know, this is left for our theological imaginations to speculate about. Perhaps it tells us that the Almighty works salvation in kind of templates that appear over and over again. That just as the Almighty does salvation this way at this time, so too he will do it that. And that is how you will recognize that it is his hand in history. It is the same way that you know, one can look at the trajectory of Jacob going down to Egypt, or Abraham. Abraham's a better example. Abraham goes down to Egypt because of a famine and gets rich and comes back to Israel. And Egypt then, and later Israel, goes down to Egypt because of a famine, gets rich on the way out, right? Because three times God says, take gold and silver from the Egyptians, and comes back to the land. So it could be that this is the analogy here between Moses and Israel is telling us about some sort of template about divine salvation, how it works. It could be that this is telling us something about the need for Moses to undergo the types of tribulations that Israel will undergo, because since Moses was raised a prince of Egypt, he doesn't have an innate identity with the slaves and with the types of experiences that they had had. And so in order to be an effective leader, maybe he needs to first go through all the things that they're going to go through so that he can relate to them, or vice versa. Maybe the people are saying, well, who is this guy? You know, he's not really one of us. Yes, you know, maybe his DNA, as it were, is ours, but, you know, he's Egyptian. He's royalty. And so, you know, we can't relate to him, that we can't trust him, he cannot be our leader. But if they see that in his own biography that he has already gone through the things that they have gone through, then perhaps that enables them to accept him as a leader. So there's many avenues of what these analogies might mean.
Joshua, before we let you go, would you tell us what you're working on these days?
Oh, wow. So glad you asked, Michael. What I'm working on now, I'm so excited about it. And it's just a thrill to be able to share. And I'm sure that I need lots of help with this one, because it's a really fascinating and big question. And it goes like this. The Hebrew word to forgive, okay, is the word lisloach. That's the infinitive lisloach. But nominally translated as to forgive, and it appears almost 50 times in the Hebrew Bible. What's striking is that all of those occurrences are solely and exclusively between a human agent and the divine. Either people asking God for this slicha, what we call forgiveness, or God granting people slicha, forgiveness. But you never find anyone asking another person for slicha, or you never find a person granting another person slicha. You also never find the word apology anywhere. No one apologizes. There is no word for apology. And really, you never find any narrative where you would see what's going on and say, yes, they are asking one another for forgiveness, using any term you want. It's just totally absent. is totally absent. And this seems totally bizarre to us because we think of the Bible as a book of instruction about how to be a good person. And you know, we certainly have at least a couple dozen stories in the Hebrew Bible of things that go on in our lives. You know, there's rupture and then you have to move to repair. Well, how do you do that? Well, we would say, well, you need to apologize. You need to ask for forgiveness and grant forgiveness. And none of that happens in the Hebrew Bible. And so the question is, what's going on here? Were these people just rude or what? And the answer is that the conventions of moving from rupture to repair are very culturally dependent. And you know, you and I and probably most of our listeners who run up in the West have something that, you know, all of us share in common, you know, that type of paradigm that I mentioned before. But it turns out that is a very modern paradigm, that a lot of cultures, even to this day, don't work that way. They do have conventions of how we move from rupture to repair, but they're not the ways that we think of doing it. And so this requires a deep dive cross-culturally to see, well, what are the ground rules that the other cultures have? What does that say about to be human, to be in a relationship, society? And then to come back to the biblical text and to try to read these texts anew and say, so how were these characters moving past the rupture that had developed between them? And so the forthcoming book is going to be called Without Apology, Without Forgiveness, The Restoration of Relationships in the Hebrew Bible.
Is there a publication date in view?
Well, to quote Churchill, maybe we're at the end of the beginning.
It's been a joy, Joshua, spending this time with you. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, good. And I wish you, Michael, and all the listeners Godspeed, and thank you so much for having me.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books and Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.